I have a topic I would like to talk about, and that topic is lyrics. Lyrics, lyrics. Now, if I were the devil, then what I would do is I would give people the gift of music, of melody composition. I'd give them the gift of music, and then I would inspire them with really evil lyrics. And that way, people would be drawn in by the power of the music. And then what they would do is they would listen to the music, and repeatedly in their minds, like a chant, would be invoked the evil of the lyrics. So I've done this once before with side one of The Wall by Pink Floyd, well, mostly by Roger Waters, but also to some degree by Pink Floyd. So if you are a fan of The Doors, you will appreciate this. If you're not, it's worth listening to the music. Not the greatest singer, but an incredibly passionate singer, man. You want to hear some amazing blues growling intensity. 5-1 is really powerful. So I'm going to give you an example of what I mean. So The Doors had some astoundingly good melodies. It's always been kind of depressing, angry, embittered, odd, strange, evil Calliope harmonica, and the sound that a clown's tinkly toes make when he steps up the xylophone of your spine to steal your brain or something like that. But I wanted to talk about the song When the Music's Over. Now, the song title and I guess theme came from when they played The Whiskey. That was one of the first clubs that they had a regular gig at. And they played The Whiskey, and very few people came to see them. There was one legendary night when they jammed with Van Morrison, but union rules forbade anyone to record it, so unfortunately that's been lost to the depths of time. But When the Music's Over was what the bar owner said to the bartender, "Hey man, when the music's over, just turn out the lights." And this became a song. Now, they used to work on these songs live with people. And then what happened was they ended up in the studio where things were obviously more sterile and arid. So there's a lot of chanting and repetition. It comes out of maybe the blues background or backdrop for these guys. There's a lot of chanting and repetition. And I'm not going to sing this, but I'll give you the lyrics. So the song goes, "When the music's over, when the music's over, yeah. When the music's over, turn out the lights, turn out the lights, turn out the lights." Okay, so not particularly sinister as yet, although it definitely becomes that way. So what are they talking about here? Well, music is an earthly secular pleasure. I love music and wish I could create more, but I have the gifts I've got, and I'm not going to complain. But music is a sensual delight. It is a thing of this earth, this world. It is a pleasure of the body. And as a pleasure of the body, it's fine, but it is not a moral pleasure. It is not a spiritual pleasure. It is not an ethical pleasure. It is not a pleasure of creating life. It is not a pleasure of doing good. It is not an altruistic pleasure. It is a sensual pleasure. It is about the body. And this song is about the body and its demonic potentials. At least I'll make the case. You'll see if I do make the case. So then it repeats when the music's over. And then he says, "When the music is your special friend, dance on fire as it intends. Music is your only friend until the end." The music is your special friend. Dance on fire as it intends. Music is your only friend until the end. Okay. When the music's over, so the music is about the body. The music is the senses. The music is the hearing and so on. And it is life. It is life. And when the music's over, turn out the lights. That means when you're dead, you're dead. This is a purely materialistic, secular, Darwinian view of human life. The lights are out when the music is over. When the body dies, there is no afterlife, there is no soul, there is no spirit. And because the music is your special friend, pleasure, earthly pleasure is your special friend, dance on fire as it intends. Now that's interesting because dance on fire is a great image because it looks like dancing is a very pleasurable activity. I love to dance myself. But dance on fire, well, on fire is dancing because your feet are burning. There's a compulsion here. You're trying to move because something is uncomfortable below. So the dancing is not just for pleasure. The dancing, because you're dancing on the fire. And it means two things. So dancing on fire, like you're standing on fire, and dance on fire, you're actually on fire yourself. You're burning yourself. Music. Now, music is your special friend, goes to music is your only friend. Music is your only friend. Bodily pleasures are your only friend. This is the narcissism. I think that Jim Morrison one of the band members was pretty concerned, and I think fairly rightfully so, that he was in a band with a complete psychopath. Music is your only friend. Bodily pleasures is your only connection to any kind of happiness. Music is your only friend. And Jim Morrison was a multiple addict. He was a food addict. He was a drug addict of various LSD and weed and mushrooms and you name it. And he was a sex addict. And he just had a wildly addictive personality. But then, of course, he was sexually abused intensely by somebody fairly close to the family for years as a child. And then when he went to his mother to ask for help, his mother did not help him, according to him. So, pleasure, bodily pleasure, sense pleasure, the hedonism, the tickling of the synapses and the senses. Music is your only friend until the end. And then it goes into a semi-chanty rap thing. It says, cancel my subscription to the resurrection. Send my credentials to the house of detention. I've got some friends inside. Or cancel my subscription to the resurrection. That's pretty clear. That means because I'm not going to live after I am dead. My body and my being die together. There's no resurrection. There's no afterlife. There's no God. And there are no abstracts. There are no concepts. Send my credentials to the house of detention. Of course, that is, I'm going to hell. Which is the dance on fire as well. I'm going to hell. I've got some friends inside. Now, that's interesting. His friends are inside, right? So he says, music is your only friend. I've got some friends inside. Well, music you experience from within inside your own mind, right? Sound waves go into your ear. Electrical impulses go to your brain. Your brain processes the sound, produces the music in your head. I've got some friends inside. His only pleasures are within himself. This is a fundamentally selfish view of the universe. He's already in hell, so to speak, right? I've got some friends inside. But he says, music is your only friend, so sense pleasures are the only friends that he has. There's no one else out there. There is only the manipulation of the universe to produce transitory pleasures within yourself. Then he says, the face in the mirror won't stop. The girl in the window won't drop. A feast of friends. Alive, she cried, waiting for me outside. The face in the mirror won't stop. So the face in the mirror is looking at the universe and seeing only yourself. That's narcissism, right? And it won't stop. He has no way to break out of his narcissism. He has no way to break out of his inward-looking psychopathy. He has no way of overcoming his mad, inward-looking, selfish barriers to actual connection with human beings in the outside. The face in the mirror won't stop. The girl in the window won't drop. A girl in the window is interesting because when we look in windows in general, we're looking for things to buy. So he can, so face in the mirror, when he looks at the world, he only sees himself. But then he looks through a window, he can only see a girl and won't drop. Won't drop. The girl in the window won't drop. This is physical lust. Girl in the window is someone you buy, someone you pay for. And he was reported to have had 14-year-old girls in his hotel room. A real hebephile, a real creep. And there's a story about him offering up a famous groupie for other men to have anal sex with when Jim Morrison was in the recording booth. Just, I mean, it was a real monster, an absolute, complete, and total. A victim as a child, and then a monster channeling demonic energy as an adult. A feast of friends, alive, she cried, waiting for me outside. A feast of friends, well, this is cannibalism, right? Eating people alive. I mean, what does fame mean other than eating people alive, hollowing them out in your own image of vanity? A feast of friends, alive, she cried. So this is the cannibalism of fame. This is the cannibalism of beauty. This is the cannibalism of success. Everybody is looking at Jim Morrison when he sings on the stage, and he's eating them alive. Now he says, before I sink into the big sleep, I want to hear the scream of the butterfly. Now the butterfly is Jesus. And if you doubt me, he mentions Jesus later. So the butterfly is the transforming object. It's the transforming species, right? It starts as a caterpillar, ends up as a butterfly. And this has traditionally meant the body, the soul, the afterlife, that you flit and escape. You go from a thing of blandness, and of course the caterpillar has a phallic aspect to it. You go from a thing of blandness, the mere flesh, the meaty weight of the body, to the butterfly. You escape the transformation, the chrysalis. You escape the body, and you become a beautiful painted sky creature, and this is the soul. The butterfly here is Jesus. Before I sink into the big sleep, I want to hear the scream of the butterfly. Now, one thing about Jim Morrison, I mean, the man had an IQ of close to 150. He was extraordinarily well-read. Sinister readings, but, you know, he's big into Norman Mailer and Rimbaud and so on. And so he was well-read and would understand the big sleep. So I'm sure he read his Plato, and this is what Socrates says about death. He says, look, what have I got to be scared of? Right? Either I go to sleep and I don't dream, it's like that, in which case, well, gosh, being asleep without dreaming is the best sleep you're ever going to get. So I'm either going to get the best sleep forever, or I have life after death, in which case I get to converse with wonderful people who've already passed. Before I sink into the big sleep, before I die, I want to hear the scream of the butterfly. So this is the natural enemy that narcissism and fleshly lusts, living like an animal, and he did, in fact, live like an animal, in that his only literary charisma, of which he had an enormous amount, his only literary charisma was to draw other people down into the life of the animal, into the life of abandoning higher purposes, concepts, higher reason, virtue, and to live like a squalid animal. It's famous that when he was at the whiskey, the band got fired because he screamed that he wanted to kill his father and rape his mother. And at the end part of the song, the end, he would scream gutturally into the microphone, kill, fuck, kill, fuck, kill, fuck, kill, fuck. Now, of course, that's the basic metronome of the predator, right? What do lions do? They kill and then they have sex to make more lions. They kill to eat and they use that energy to create. So kill, fuck, kill, fuck. That's the animal. That's the old thing about people look at a beautiful meadow with butterflies and birds and it's like, well, it's just a whole bunch of animals trying to not be eaten or eat others and have sex. That's all you're looking at. So kill, fuck, kill, fuck. The scream of the butterfly means that he wants his baseness is to torture the higher potential of man. To dive down into the animal is to torture the higher potential. And the butterfly, of course, is himself, his higher self. He's casting himself down into this life of a squalid, fetid, sewage-based animal is to torture his higher self. And of course, without a doubt, he was raised religious. And his parents did not hit him, but his parents engaged in unbelievably vicious verbal abuse towards him, which he then turns to the audience and verbally abuses the audience. And the famous line from the Soft Parade is, I was back there in seminary school. They put forth the proposition that you can petition the Lord with prayer. I want to beg the Lord to save me. I want to beg the Lord to save me. Without a doubt, when Jim Morrison was a little boy, helpless, innocent child, and he was being repeatedly raped, he screamed out to God for help. He screamed out to God, to Jesus, for salvation. Because after he says, they put forth the proposition that you can petition the Lord with prayer, he screams at the top of his tortured lungs, you cannot petition the Lord with prayer. You cannot petition the Lord with prayer. This rage against the higher is because you believe in the higher, you believe in the abstract, you believe in God's virtues. And as you are being repeatedly screamed at and raped as a child, you cry out to the higher, to the abstract, to the concept, to the higher man. You scream out for the concepts and the living God to come and save you. And God does not come and save you. And in your rage and despair, the devil takes you and uses you to amplify his message. So then he says, come back, baby, back into my arms. We're getting tired of hanging around, waiting around with our heads to the ground. So he wants fleshly lusts again. The girl, we're getting tired of hanging around. So later on in his life, Jim Morrison said, openly, he said, I'm losing my soul. I'm losing my soul. And the weariness of the life of the beast. I mean, animals don't get tired of the life of animals because they can't be anything other than animals. But we sure as hell get tired of the life of an animal because we can be so much more. Staying in the mere realm of the fleshly senses is like taking grade two over and over and over and over again for the rest of your life. Of course, you get tired, you get bored, you get exhausted, you get distracted, and you get despair, and you get depression, and you get anxiety because you're wasting your life. And chasing the endorphins, chasing the mere physical sensual high has, I mean, iron law of diminishing followed by negative returns. Getting tired of hanging around, it's all you do. It's all you do when you chase the senses is you're just hanging around. Waiting around with our heads to the ground. Right? The butterfly goes up and he is going down. His head is to the ground. He can't raise himself from the grim pre-human pits of evolution. He's got his head to the ground. I hear a very gentle sound and then the guitarist has a little, very soft, yeah, very clear, come today, come today. And then, so he has a very gentle sound. Now, the life of the sense pleasures generally are quite, it's quite intense, right? Sex, orgasm, intense. Overeating, intense. Drugs, very intense. Alcohol, very intense. And the music that they played, crashingly loud, very intense. Intense music. So for him to hear a gentle sound, over the cacophony of the body and of the senses, hearing the soul, hearing the higher being, hearing the reason, is a very gentle sound, it's a very distant sound. Very near, yet very far, very soft, yet very clear. Come today, come today. I think this is Jesus, this is the higher self, this is God. Now, he hears the wounding of himself. He hears that he is wounded. And his ear is down to the ground. His head is down to the ground. And instead of focusing on his own wounds, on all of the horror that is inside his head, cannibalism, and all of the other horrors that are going on in his head, what he does is he takes, and this is really one of the first, if not the first, ecological or ecologically conscious songs. Because he senses when he hears the distant sound, the quiet sound of his higher self, he gets a sense of his own self-wounding. Wounded as a child, now self-wounding as an adult. And the wound of his self, the wound of his soul, becomes something that he can feel, something that he can sense. And he transforms it. He will not stay on the wounding of himself. He will not do it. And instead, he looks at the wounding of the world, of nature. What have they done to the earth? What have they done to our fair sister? Ravished and plundered and bit her and ripped her. Stuck her with knives in the side of the dawn and tied her with fences and dragged her down. I hear a very gentle sound with your ear down to the ground. We want the world and we want it now. Ah, that's some great lyrics. Some great lyrics. They're great, powerful lyrics. He can't stand his own pain. He can't process his own pain. So instead he says, oh, it's the world that's been wounded. It's the earth that has been wounded. And if you look at people who are obsessed with ecological damage, with the world being polluted, well, they're really talking about their childhoods. Now, this is not to say that, you know, pollution is an important issue. I get all of that. But the people who are crazed about it, they are taking the wounds they experienced as children and projecting them onto the earth. And then they feel that if they just can protect the earth, that somehow they can save themselves when they were younger. What have they done to the earth? Now, ravished and plundered and ripped her and bit her, stuck her with knives in the side of the dawn. Okay, stuck with knives in the side, that's Jesus, right? Jesus is gored in his side with a spear. And the dawn, right? Stuck her with knives in the side of the dawn, tied her with fences and dragged her down. So tied her with fences is, why do people have a hatred of property? Imagine there's no property, you know. Why do they have a hatred of property? Well, they have a hatred of property because as children they were treated as property. They were treated as property. And you hate property when you are treated as property and when you abuse a child, when you beat a child, when you scream at a child, when you rape a child, when you molest a child, you're treating that child as property. And so a lot of leftists come from child abuse and they hate property because they were treated as property. Now, then, of course, this is the great satanic temptation. We want the world and we want it now. We want the world and we want it now. The world is the body. The world is sense pleasures. The world is objects. The world is things. What should it profit a man if he gain the whole world but lose his soul? This is what Satan offers to Jesus, takes him to the rooftops of the world and says, everything can be yours, just renounce God, renounce your higher self, renounce virtue, renounce abstractions, and live like a beast. Live like a beast. Persian night babe, see the light babe. So Persian night, Persia is, I guess now Iran, but Persia was a place of sensuality. Shahrazad and 1001 Arabian Nights. It was a place of sensuality, spices and drugs and sex, right? Persian Nights, babe. See the light, babe. So in the middle of this sense exploitation fest of hedonism, he sees the light and he screams out, save us, Jesus, save us. And he does this live, I think it was on Swedish TV, and his voice cracks when he says, Jesus. And this is, of course, in the grip of this demonic lust, this demonic exploitation. The I was treated as property, so I will treat people as property. And that's what he's desperate for. Now, Jesus here would be, I mean, Jesus, of course, as you would know Jesus, But Jesus is all just some higher self, some higher capacity, some higher reason, some abstraction. Please, God, please, something, please, philosophy, save me from this squalid lust of degradation and addiction and cannibalism. Save me from eating others. And it's really, it's an incredible thing in music when you hear this essentially satanic figure screaming for Jesus to save him. But Jesus does not come in the song. Jesus does not arrive to save him at all. Because we end where we began. We end where we began. So when the music's over, yeah, when the music's over, turn out the lights, turn out the light, turn out the light. He just ends up where he began. Music is your only friend until the end. This is the despair. This is when you give up and you lose the fight. You give up and you lose the fight. Music is your only friend. Sense pleasure will be all that you have until the end. And sense pleasure consumes us. Diving into sense pleasure is like diving without a scuba gear, or with a scuba gear if you like. We can't live down there. We can enjoy the sights. We can enjoy the sex and food and movement and all of those pleasures. Wonderful things. Wonderful. They're the spice of life, but they're not the meal of life. The meal of life is the higher. The meal of life are the abstractions. The meal of life is philosophy, because that's what we are capable of. If you see an animal refusing to use its most powerful attribute, can you imagine seeing a lion that refuses to chew or bite, a bird that refuses to fly, a fish that refuses to swim? We know that something is desperately wrong with that organism. And human beings who refuse to reason, we have taken our greatest power and cast it down into the depths of mere fleshly pleasures. A lot of animals walk, and that's not a problem. But if an animal can fly, but only walks, then that which is its greatest mode of transportation is unused. And if you have a bird that never flies, something is wrong, desperately wrong with the bird. It has evolved flight, and all it does is walk. A fish flops onto land, can't evolve quickly enough, it dies. It's not swimming anymore. And when we take what we've evolved to be, or have been granted by God to be, abstract reasoning beings, and we take that and we cast it aside, or we use our abstractions only for manipulation and the gathering of resources and the pretense of virtue, then we have savaged and destroyed our most powerful attribute, and we are not free when we don't reason, when we refuse to reason, when we refuse to think. We are not free. You are either a slave to reason, which is to be free in reality, or you're a slave to your body, which is to be degraded to the level of an ape. And yet, since we cannot be an ape, we can only ape the ape, as the Peter Gabriel song says. We can't be animals. We have the souls of reason in our minds. We can't be animals. And this song, Sense Pleasure, we die when we die. My only possible pleasure is satisfying addiction. When I am faced with cannibalism, I scream to Jesus for salvation. But I lose. And why did Jim Morrison lose? Jim Morrison lost. It is vastly better to be sinned against than sinning. Jim Morrison lost for the reason that, if you look around in your life, I'm sure you can confirm this, and if you can't, please tell me, let me know. But Jim Morrison lost because he had turned from victim to victimizer. He wounded others. He had sex with children. He took knives out and threatened women. One woman stumbled in to the recording studio with a huge bruise on her leg. And the keyboardist said, "What happened?" "Oh, man, Jim hit me in the leg." He had turned violent. And that's why he could not be saved. And all he could do was amplify the demonology of his own destruction. That's all he had left. To turn from virtuous to victim, to victimizer, to amplifier. That story of fame, for the most part. And once you've done that, it seems to be almost inevitably the case, once you've done that, Jesus himself, philosophy himself, cannot save you. Please, please, I'm begging you, friends, learn this lesson. Refrain from doing evil. Refrain from doing evil. And we're all tempted. Of course, I understand that. But you must refrain from doing evil, because if you do evil in a matter which cannot be restored, cannot be recovered. I mean, Jim Morrison didn't start out as a monster when he was a kid. One of his neighbors was another boy his own age who was dying of leukemia. And Jim Morrison went over every day for 6 months playing records and trying to cheer this guy. He didn't start out as a monster. I don't believe anybody really does. Didn't start out as a monster. But evil did its work on him. And why do we choose evil? Well, because as animals, all animals, what are we drawn to? We're drawn to power. We're drawn to power. And who seems to run the world? Well, it ain't the Boy Scouts and it ain't the nuns. Who seems to run the world? So when he was being raped and abused as a boy, he screamed out for goodness, for virtue, for philosophy, for God, for Jesus, and all the saints and apostles to come and save him. And nothing happened. And like all children, particularly boys, he was drawn to power. And he became what destroyed him. And he worked to help demonize and destroy the world. And then the devil came and took his life when he was 27 in a bathtub in Paris. He had fled to Paris to get away from charges that he had exposed his genitalia to thousands of people during a concert and faced 5 months of hard time. And he fled. The hard time would probably have been better for him because at least he would have had more difficulty getting his endless supply of drugs. The devil vaulted him to the atmosphere, used Jim Morrison to amplify, to set the demonic lyrics to addictive music so that those train tracks could be carved in people's brains. "No eternal reward will forgive us now for wasting the dawn," is another one of his lyrics. The dawn is youth, of course. And apparently, to not pursue sensual pleasures is to waste your youth. So I think it's really fascinating to see how this stuff plays out in the world. But I will turn to you, the fine listeners. We have somebody who wishes to chat. Let me just get my little headset in here. And yes, Kuroko, I will be with you in just a moment. All right, you can just unmute yourself. I'm all ears.
Hello, can you hear me clearly?
I cannot hear you clearly at all. It sounds like you're deep-throating the microphone. You'll need to back away a little bit.
Well, that sucks. Sorry, skip to another guy. I'll try to find a solution that's wrong with my
Okay, I don't know what the hell people do. I don't know what you do. What do people do when they call into the show? Do you not test your audio? Do you? Blah, 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 blah. It's just strange to me. If I was called in to talk to someone, I would do them the slight courtesy of at least testing my audio. But maybe that's just me. All right, Mr. Goy, go ahead.
Hey, what's up, Stefan? How you doing, brother?
Good. How you doing?
I'm okay. Question though, he went to France. He died in France, but there was some speculation that he might have faked his death. What do you think on that?
I don't think that that's the case. I don't think that's true. I've heard of that, of course, about a lot of people. I mean, his body was cremated, and they just basically guessed that it was a heart issue, but they didn't really test for that. I don't think he faked his own death. I don't think there was enough of him left to save. So, yeah, the faking his own death, I don't particularly believe it. And it's the kind of thing where, like, he was so famous that if he'd faked his own death, the idea that he would never have been seen again for the rest of time. I mean, he was one of the classical beauties, particularly when he was slender. One of the classical beauties. He had sort of unmistakable features, unmistakable hair, and an unmistakable voice. And the idea, I think, that nobody would ever have seen him again, or there would be no record of him at all. I think that's mostly wishful thinking. But again, you may know more about it than I do. What do you think?
I don't know. It was interesting because I guess his wife or long-term girlfriend had died shortly after as well. So, you know, it would make sense, you know, if like you were going to plan something like that, that you and a spouse would eventually just, you know, could fake your death and then go to like Asia, where nobody has even heard of the Doors, you know, like Cambodia or, you know, Southeast Asia, for instance.
But I mean, I guess how would he live? I mean, would he just like get a job as a rice farmer, or like what would he do? And his health was so wrecked by, you know, just years and years and years of the most rampant addiction. I mean, it's hard to think that he would be able to handle a physical job. He wouldn't have any access to his money. He wouldn't have a passport. I mean, it would seem strange. There is another theory, of course, that he was killed in a night, or he died in a nightclub, that people found him in a toilet in a local nightclub, and that he died from bad drugs. And there are a number of people, again, who knows what the truth is, but there are a number of people who claim to have, you know, the reason that they moved him. They moved his body after he died in the toilet of bad drugs. They moved his body back to his apartment because they didn't want an investigation into the dealers. They didn't want the club to get shut down. And so they basically just dumped him back in his bathtub at home. And that's how he was found. And that's sort of another theory as to what happened. But no, I don't think here, no one here gets out alive.
I guess follow-up question is, how is his influence and media affected modern media today? Do you have any like ideas or comments on that?
Can you just shape the question a little more for me? That's a bit open-ended.
Okay, so his like the way his demeanor was, he was, you know, he's a rock star, he was larger than life. And do you see modern influencers like Madonna and I guess who was that other chick that, you know, I'm talking about these teen boppers nowadays, how they just go over the top and there's just no filter, you know what I mean? And you look at Two Live Crew as well, with explicit lyrics and things of that nature, and how over time the evolution of media has gotten more vulgar, more outlandish, and more untamed, you know what I mean, in a lot of ways.
Oh, I think the word, maybe you would not be as comfortable with this that I would, but the word is, I think, straight up demonic. I mean, if you look at sort of modern singers, modern pop stars, it's straight up demonic. And no bones about it, straight up demonic. I mean, if you look at Lady Gaga's videos, it's straight up demonic. She's, you know, there are pictures of her with these sort of spirit cooking demonic rituals. And it's, I mean, if you look at Billie Eilish, I mean, straight up demonic stuff. You know, My Boy is pretty clearly a love letter to Satan. He's just trying to be his father, right? My boy, don't love me like he's promised. Well, that's Satan offering you things. And then not not getting them. And yeah, so I mean, if you look at the lyrics for My Boy, which was her, one of her big breakout hits, I mean, it's straight up demonic. If you look at When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? Bury a Friend, straight up demonic. They even have that arched back demonic stuff. So, you know, one of the theory from a theological standpoint would be something like this, that the devil gives people great music in order to infect demonic language into people's heads, because they sing it, they chant it, they cheer it, they listen to it, it just grooves into their brain. And you see in music, popular music, all of this incredibly demonic stuff. And when was the last time that you heard a song in the mainstream that praised Jesus, that praised God? What, Spirit in the Sky by Greenbaum? I mean, I suppose that's quite a long way back in the day. But, I mean, you know, I know that, of course, there is Christian popular music and so on, but I'm talking about that in the mainstream. In the mainstream, where do you see the angelic influence, the holy influence, the Jesus influence? It's all straight up demonic. Now, again, I'm not a particular believer in demons as literal entities, but they are powerful analogies for the corruption of the human mind through the abasement before the mere senses. So if you look at modern music as a whole, the messages are straight up demonic. And there's really little even hiding of it. The symbols that are used, it seems to me pretty... And it's ever, I mean, Microsoft, Abramovich, this, I don't know, half-witch crazy lady who does some of the spirit cooking stuff, who showed up in Podesta's emails. I mean, that's... They wanted to sponsor, I think, an event of hers or something. Like, you know, when would they do that to a parish priest with a great message? So yeah, we do live in a pretty dark age as far as all that goes. And, you know, I mean, arguably some of the best people who are deplatformed, or some of the people who are deplatformed, have the best and most honest and most challenging moral messages, and they get deplatformed, but the most appalling stuff stays up on social media. I've sort of posted about this and talked about this before, like the most appalling people and the most appalling stuff gets maintained on social media. And late stage statism is indistinguishable from Satanism in many ways. There's a reason why my main character in my novel, The Future, is called Lewis Staten, right? Because it's a combination of Lucifer, the state, and Satan, Lewis Staten. So yeah, I think it's straight up demonic stuff that's going on. And because in a sense, the mask is off, because you can see it, I think, very, very clearly. I was still naive enough to be sort of jaw-dropped when I would see this stuff going on. I remember Bad Romance, the video, just like my jaw hitting the floor, like, holy crap, are they ever putting this stuff right out there in the open? But yeah, I think that's where we are.
Can I ask the last question regarding nihilism? Because I believe... Morrison was big into nihilism and philosophy, and you see a lot of, you could see some similar parallels with like revolutions throughout the world, you know, as far as like French Revolution and nihilism, and then Freemasonry and Illuminati, you know, influence. What do you think on that?
Did you say someone was big into nihilism or something?
Jim Morrison, he was a big avid reader of nihilism and of reading, you know, what was the philosopher? I can't remember. That was the big on
Nietzsche.
Off top, Nietzsche. Sorry,
he was a big Nietzsche for sure.
So how was that? How did nihilism and Nietzsche like influence his ideology and his writing? Do you think there's a significant parallel there?
Well, yeah, I think so. So Nietzsche had an analysis of power rather than an analysis of virtue. So his analysis of virtue was from the standpoint of power. So Nietzsche would say that Christianity was invented by people who were too weak to take what they wanted. So they instilled a sense of guilt and obligation and altruism in others. He called it a slave morality. That because you can't achieve things in the world as it stands, because you're a slave, you have to invent slavery as a virtue. The meek shall inherit the earth. And you have to create a fantasy of revenge. And the fantasy of revenge is, well, boy, after they're dead, man, after we're dead, they're going to hell and I'm going to heaven. Meek shall inherit the earth, and it is easier for a... It is easier for something to pass through the eye of it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. So he said, well, they had no power, so they had to invent a world where being powerless was virtuous, and then they had to invent an afterlife where their vengeance fantasies could be expressed or manifested without any personal danger to themselves. Now, this is a tragically seductive theory of Christianity. Christianity's goal was to move morality from the tribal to the universal. It's the most philosophical religion that I know, and again, I don't know a lot about a lot of religions, but that's sort of my approach to it and what I've seen. So, to gain resources, there's nothing more efficient than using morality, false morality, to gain resources. Like, people care about the cleanliness of the environment, so you can invent all sorts of environmental hysterias in order to get resources from people. And so using abstractions rather than to serve virtue and truth and reason and philosophy and evidence, using abstractions as a method of predation is time-honored. I made an argument many years ago that morality was in fact invented as a tool of exploitation, and only when it was wrestled from exploitation to universal did it become a problem for the people in power. But nihilism is the attempt to use reason, to use values, to use our capacity for concepts to destroy our capacity to conceive of things. It is an attempt to use philosophy to destroy philosophy in the same way that people use morality in order to destroy morality. So nihilism is a giant weapon used to undermine any moral or philosophical interference in the satanic pursuit of degrading pleasures by the body, by the soulless person. It is a decapitation mechanism that attempts to unseat our capacity for reason, using reason. There is nothing more pleasurable to the sadist than to use the weapons of his enemy against himself. I remember once reading a death threat that was written to a guy who was a staunch capitalist and say, I've gone to the dark web to procure your blah, blah, blah. And it's like, but you should approve of this because you're a capitalist, because you're a capitalist, right? There's a special sadism. There's a special pleasure in the sadist in harnessing his enemy's values and using them against him. And that's what nihilism is. Nihilism, the argument that there are no values, is so transparently false and ridiculous. It's an insult to children to even call it a childish philosophy. But it's a very foolish and degraded philosophy. It's a philosophy that's trying to destroy philosophy in the same way that people use arguments to try and destroy free will. And people use lust as a substitute for love. People use drugs as a substitute for virtue. It's trying to harness the mechanisms of the mind and the body to destroy the mechanisms of the mind and the body. It's like a cancer that hijacks the blood supply in order to feed itself and destroy life. So yes, without a doubt, he had the calling and the reaching for the higher abstract self, for that which makes us most specifically and energetically human, our capacity to think in the abstract. But that was a grave threat to him, because when we think in the abstract, we connect with other people, we overcome our narcissism, we overcome our selfishness, we surrender ourselves to objectivity, we become deeply and fully connected to humanity, to the universe, to each other. As I said, we can only meet in reality, and those who deny reality steel themselves in the tombs of their own narcissism. The face in the mirror won't stop. And Jim Morrison was murderous towards his girlfriends. The girl in the window won't drop. Well, because when you're murderous to people and you're famous, then you drive people away from you, but then what happens? More people come along. Right? The girl in the window won't drop. I can't enter the girl in the window because I drive one girl away, and because I'm famous, rich, and beautiful and talented, another girl just comes right along. So yeah, I definitely do view nihilism as one of these philosophies or philosophical approaches that is sadistically using our capacity for reason to try and destroy our capacity to reason. And once we can be sealed up in the tombs of our own self-regard, we have no danger to anyone anymore. All we'll generally do is spread it. So, all right, well, listen, thanks everyone for dropping by today. A little bit of a shorter show, but I just wanted to drop by and say hi to everyone. I hope you're doing very well. I hope you're having a wonderful time. freedomain.com/donate if you'd like to help out the show. Boy, I really, really would appreciate it. And oh, and by the way, justpournovel.com. You should check out my novel, Just Poor. I was looking for something else the other day, and I found my original ending to Just Poor. The last third of Just Poor was very different from the ending that finally showed up. So I think I'll throw that up on freedomain.locals.com and you can read my original ending to Just Poor, which has its own strengths and glories as well. And I hope that you'll check that out. It'll be very interesting if you've actually read the book to see the director's cut, alternative ending, and so on. So listen, have I think I'll do that call another time. So yeah, thanks everyone so much for dropping by today. Have yourself a wonderful afternoon. Lots of love from up here. I'll talk to you soon.